Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina, here with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, reclaimed wood is all the rage these days, but just how do barn planks end up as beautiful pieces of furniture or flooring? We'll learn more about the unbuilding process and the benefits it can provide.
First, it's time for our weekly roundup of national news stories. The Trump administration has decided to expel 60 Russian diplomats from the country and closed a Russian consulate. Lawmakers and leaders are weighing in on the new national security advisor, and states are suing the government over adding a citizenship question to the 2020 census.
You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you think kicking Russian diplomats out of the country is the right response to an attack on a Russian ex-spy in the UK? Will it deter such attacks in the future? And what do you think of National Security Advisor John Bolton? Do you think we need a hard line on North Korea and Iran, or does it not concern you? Call in now with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can also send an email to ideas at WPR.org.
Tracy Wilkinson is a reporter covering foreign affairs for the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times. Tracy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
So, Tracy, let's start with that decision to expel 60 Russian diplomats from the U.S. and close the Russian consulate in Seattle. Give us just a bit of background. What led up to this step?
Well, this came in response to the attack in Britain on a former Soviet spy, Sergei Skripal, and his adult daughter. A nerve agent was used to attack, to poison them. Basically, they're still in critical condition. Didn't kill them, but they were very badly hurt. And so, after many such activities by Russia, allegedly by Russia, the United States has over time gradually taken sanctions here and there. But this has been finally the toughest, most aggressive response to date, expelling 60 Russian diplomats is apparently the largest expulsion, at least since the Cold War and possibly even before that. So it's quite dramatic, and it was taken in coordination with many countries around the world, mostly in Europe, I think 26 other countries or international organizations. So it's come as a very tough response to that attack. It follows, as I say, sanctions that have been imposed for other reasons, such as Russian meddling in 2016 elections and those sorts of things. But this one was specifically in response to that attack, using a nerve agent, a chemical weapon, essentially, on the soil of a NATO ally and close partner of the United States.
Well, and Tracy, as you said, this is not the first time that there have been attacks on people that Russia sees as now enemies. But Moscow has always denied involvement, as they did this time. And it's an interesting time, really, because Europe is not as united as it has been, partly because of Brexit and that dynamic. But as you said, European countries, others, and the United States are really taking a very united stance on this.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, a few European countries did not join in, and that's also notable. But a lot of countries say they have also experienced interference or some sort of meddling by Russia. Estonia, some of the former Soviet republics, France, Germany, you know, they all have said that they think Russia has been meddling in their elections. So I think that that was impetus for there to be a much more united stance than you might expect.
What are we hearing from the White House about this move?
Well, that's interesting. The White House announced the move, but Donald Trump has not said word one about it, which is kind of interesting. He normally, and this could be seen as a very tough, successful action, and he, you know, rarely shies away from claiming credit for these kinds of forceful actions, and he has not tweeted, he has not said word one about this. The White House has, as I said, announced it, and it said it was, you know, a critical action to take and in coordination with our allies and in support of Britain. But Trump himself has remained unusually quiet for his style, though not so unusual in terms of his regard for Vladimir Putin and Russia.
Well, and reports that I read said that in the conversation that President Trump had with Vladimir Putin last week, congratulating him on his election, when this topic did not come up, and yet here we are just a few days later, really, and this major action has been taken. Do we get a sense that this expulsion was coming from President Trump or from those around him?
Well, his staff insisted it was his decision, but I'm certain that it was weeks in the making, that the State Department had a big role in encouraging this. And I think there, you know, there are members of his staff. In fact, most of Trump's staff is much more willing to be forceful about Russia. So I think this was kind of percolating around him, and then they say he ultimately signed off on it. But as you know, he's always very reluctant to criticize Putin or Russia. And as you mentioned, that phone call just last week where he congratulates Putin on an election that, you know, many of the monitors said was a sham, and yet he congratulates Putin on that and does not raise this issue of the attack in Britain.
We are talking with Tracy Wilkinson right now. She covers foreign affairs for the Los Angeles Times, and we're taking a look at some of the biggest news stories this week out of Washington, many of which have that international aspect. Tracy, moving on to John Bolton being named National Security Advisor, taking the place of H.R. McMaster. What do we know about Bolton's reputation and experience?
Well, he has a very harsh reputation, actually. A lot of people in the foreign policy community were alarmed at his appointment. He is we called him a take-no-prisoner kind of guy. He's very forceful. He's very much a hawk. He has advocated regime change and bombing North Korea and Iran. So he's taken some pretty, you know, I think some people would call extreme positions. He's also very experienced in Washington, though. You know, he was the UN ambassador under Bush, and he's been around these circles for a long time. So unlike McMaster, he actually knows how Washington works and can probably get a lot of things done. But I think the concern is, among many people, that McMaster and Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State were two of the voices that would sort of bring Trump back from the more radical positions that he might be advocating, and could argue for why, you know, certain things should happen a certain way. And now both are gone. McMaster's gone, and Tillerson was fired and is being replaced, if he's confirmed, by CIA Director Mike Pompeo. So there you also have a fairly hardline, hawkish voice. So I think that's the concern, that there won't be dissenting voices any longer in the White House.
It's interesting because it seems like Bolton has always taken the go-it-alone approach to American foreign policy. He, even though he was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, he had spoken very openly about the fact that he didn't think the United Nations should exist. And it seems like he's really in step with President Trump in the, we can do this on our own when we see it in our own best interest.
Yes, definitely. This America first, America only attitude. You're right. He has not advocated for multilateral institutions at all. He advocated for getting rid of the UN as he was ambassador to it. And, you know, I don't think sees much need for the EU. I don't know about NATO. I mean, I think he would understand that NATO is important. But generally, he very much sees pursuing U.S. interests as the first and foremost and only goal. And you're right, it's very much in step with what Donald Trump has advocated.
Former President Jimmy Carter was among those critical of the appointment of John Bolton. Here he is talking about the president's decision.
John Bolton has been the worst mistake he's made. He's advocated going to war preemptively against North Korea, against Iraq, against Iran even. And so I think that is particularly ill-advised, because the National Security Advisor, I know from experience, is the most listened to advice that a president gets.
Jimmy Carter there talking about the appointment of John Bolton as National Security Advisor. And Tracy, you know, North Korea is one of the biggest foreign policy issues on the table right now, with a possible meeting between President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un coming up in May. How do you see the appointment of John Bolton affecting that possibility?
Well, it could perhaps scare the North Koreans. Seeing someone that hard line in that job, if they're paying that close of attention, it possibly could make them sort of sit up and take notice and decide that they've got to do something about that. On the other hand, it might discourage them from making any kinds of concessions. So it's a little dicey to see how that's going to go. You might have seen that Kim went to Beijing this week, and that was a first that we know of him traveling outside of his country as leader of North Korea. But I think it was largely to sort of shore up his bargaining position, to sort of show that he and China are on the same page in this, which has not been clear lately. So he's definitely getting ready, Kim is, but I think the Bolton could be a bit of a wrench in the works here.
Are we hearing much support for the Bolton appointment? Are there some supporters who are really glad to see him in that position?
There are some. There are a few Republicans on Capitol Hill who praised the appointment. And judging from my mail, there are quite a few people out there who thought it was a good idea. They like the toughness. But I think most of your experts in the foreign policy community have expressed concern.
Let's move on to the 2020 census. This week, the Commerce Department announced it would be putting a question on the next census asking whether someone is a U.S. citizen or not. And there was immediate backlash, and several states are planning to take legal action over that decision. Why is including a citizenship question causing such a stir?
Well, I think a lot of states, including California, think that question will scare a lot of people who maybe are not here legally or who are not citizens, and cause them not to participate in the census at all, meaning they aren't counted. And if you have hundreds of thousands of people who are not counted, obviously in California's case, you could lose millions of dollars in federal revenue and even possibly a congressional seat. So I think the concern is that question will drive people away from participating. People are already nervous about providing personal information, and I think in this climate, especially immigrants are very nervous. And so I think that the concern is that there would be an undercount, that question will scare so many people away.
Let's take a listen to White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders talking about the decision.
We've contained this question that's provided data that's necessary for the Department of Justice to protect voters and specifically to help us better comply with the Voting Rights Act.
Tracy, what is the connection between adding this census question and enforcing the Voting Rights Act?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not quite sure. They contend that they want to be sure that the right people, in other words, the people who legitimately are authorized to vote. But a lot of the critics think it's sort of a bogus connection being made. It's going to be difficult for the opponents to prove that case, especially this late in the process. But the information they say would allow them to more accurately calculate who should be voting and then how many actually vote and turn out and those sorts of things.
Sarah Sanders also claimed that a citizenship question has been included in every census from 1965 until 2010. Is that accurate?
No. I've got notes actually on that. It has been included in some surveys, but not in the 10-year full census, and since the 50s.
We're talking with Tracy Wilkinson, a reporter covering international affairs for the Los Angeles Times, recapping some of the top stories out of Washington.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with the plan to add a question about U.S. citizenship to the 2020 census, or do you see it as a political move? Are you worried about its effect on federal funding or redistricting? And with President Trump suggesting that the U.S. military pay for a border wall with Mexico, where do you think the money should come from? Or should a wall or border security even be a priority at all? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about the top national political stories of the week with Tracy Wilkinson. She's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times based in Washington, D.C.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Where does border security rank in your list of national priorities? And is a wall with Mexico important to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Tracy, let's talk about that border wall funding. It's a border wall with Mexico continues to be something that President Trump is pursuing. Finding the funds for that wall has been a challenge. And he tweeted out a new suggestion this week. What was his proposition?
He's now saying maybe the military can pay for it, you know, borrow from the Pentagon's budget, which is a hefty budget, we might add. It's a huge increase that he's asked for and is getting. And so his suggestion is that they could pay for it, the argument being that, you know, the border security is a national security issue, and so it would be appropriate for military funds to go to it. I'm not sure how that's going to fly. I have a lot of opinions about how appropriate a border wall is, and I don't think that I'm not sure. I don't know that his supporters care how it's paid for as much as it being built, but I just don't think that. Well, we'll see if the military is going to be willing. It shows that he's not been able to get Congress to pay for it, to get clearly Mexico to pay for it. So he is sort of scrambling. And Vice President Pence just again yesterday talked about how we're going to build the wall. So it is something they are still talking about.
Let's go to the phones, and Corey in Sheboygan Falls is up first. Hi, Corey.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. What would you like to say?
I just wanted to call in and give my opinion about the wall. And I mean, I don't think it's a necessary thing. I mean, people can go over, under, around. I mean, most people stay on overstayed visas, from my understanding. The other thing is, it's just, again, another lie, as I thought Mexico is paying for said wall. And, I mean, it's just being passed on to the American taxpayers again. And it's something that's totally unnecessary just to make people, I don't know, get riled up about a problem that really isn't so severe.
All right. Thanks so much for that call, Corey. And, Tracy, one of the questions is, how easy is it to say we're going to divert money from the defense budget into this? It seems like there are probably some hurdles to go through for that as well.
Well, there would be some hurdles, but also the Pentagon has some discretionary funds that I suppose they could use. But I agree with the caller in that, you know, most the Trump administration talks about blocking illegal drugs coming into the United States from Mexico. Well, most of those drugs are smuggled in through checkpoints, through legal established checkpoints. And so building a wall doesn't stop that. Illegal immigration from Mexico is actually, at least by Mexicans, is actually down, and in fact is now as many Mexicans leave as come. That's not an issue anymore. So the wall seems to be more of a political issue than a really practical issue.
And the omnibus spending bill that was signed last week, President Trump wanted a significant amount of money, basically funding for the whole wall, but got what he referred to instead as a down payment. How much did he get of what he was expecting?
I don't know. I don't know. It was a fraction. He was not happy.
Let's go on to Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, Speaker of the House. Rumors again circulating that he is planning to resign as Speaker. That comes from a fellow Republican. What was being said, and where are those rumors coming from?
Well, they're coming from as you mentioned, this other Republican. Paul Ryan's office denied it. They said he's not planning to go anywhere, but, you know, you know more about Wisconsin politics than I. There may be other a lot of other factors behind there. Clearly, it's not been a good time to be Speaker in the sense that you've got a, you know, an unpredictable president who doesn't always back you up, and midterms are coming up that could be problematic for a lot of the Republicans. So it's a dicey time, but I don't see any hard evidence that Paul Ryan will be quitting.
How successful has Paul Ryan been in raising money for national Republican causes and for specific Republicans who are running for reelection?
I think he's been fairly successful. I don't think money is really ever the problem for Republican candidates. They seem to have money. The question now is going to be more about messaging and, you know, certain anti-Trump sentiment that does exist in some parts of the country, and other, you know, other issues, women's issues and those sorts of things. I don't think money is as big a problem.
Let's go back to the phones, and Sharon in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Sharon.
Yes.
Hi. What would you like to share?
You were talking about the issue of the wall. I just wanted to share that although border security is something that is actually important, I don't think that a wall in the year 2018 is the appropriate way to address that.
And what do you think would be more appropriate, Sharon?
That's a good. I think using. I don't have a really great answer for that. But it's building a physical structure when it's not, I mean, we have air travel. I mean, there are things in place now that actually, you know, checking people's passports, et cetera.
And your phone quality is not great, Sharon, so we'll leave it there as we're ending the segment shortly. Tracy, it does seem that a border wall isn't necessarily taking advantage of some advances in technology and newer approaches to things like security.
Indeed, there are a lot of technological ways to better monitor the border. You could beef up and better train the Border Patrol. But a wall, a physical wall, makes no sense. And the money that is in the budget now is for fencing and repairing fences that already exist. You know, there are already physical barriers along a lot of that border. So building a wall just seems so retro, frankly.
Well, Tracy, thanks so much for spending the time with us today. We enjoyed it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Tracy Wilkinson is a reporter covering foreign affairs for the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times. She was with us for a weekly look at the top stories in national politics.
Buying wood for your home may not always be the most exciting process, but what if that wood had a story? Thanks to a growing deconstruction or unbuilding movement, old timber is often taking on new life in Wisconsin, and reclaimed wood from barns, factories, and other buildings is becoming a hot commodity.
Our next guest recently wrote about unbuilding and reclaimed wood for the website wiscontext.org. He says consumer interest in unique wood products is driving a market for reclaimed wood, and it could have some big benefits for Wisconsin.
Scott Bovey is a professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also a wood product specialist with the University of Wisconsin Extension. He's stationed in Woodruff, Wisconsin at the Kemp Natural Resources Station. Scott, thanks so much for joining us today.
That's my pleasure.
So you write in your piece that reclaimed wood is still kind of a niche market, and yet there are a lot of people who want to get their hands on this product. What kind of consumer demand are we seeing for reclaimed wood in Wisconsin?
Well, that's really difficult to say because reclaimed wood, we just don't have the metrics to measure it like we would some of the virgin material that's produced in our mills. So it's really hard to put an estimate on the volume. You saw in the piece that they mentioned that up to 30% of some of the wood that's sold in the Habitat for Humanity restores is wood products. So there's an idea of some of the volumes that you can see across the state.
Do you have a sense of when this trend towards reclaimed wood really started to take off here in the state?
Well, it's probably been in the last 10 years, maybe less. Like I mentioned before, reclaimed wood, we wouldn't necessarily need to use it because we do produce a lot of new material, but reclaimed wood can offer features that new material can't, just the life history of it, some of the character and patina that you can find in 100-year-old beams that you just can't find in new material.
And who's buying this wood? Are we talking about individuals? Are we talking about business owners? Or maybe a little bit of both?
I think certainly a little bit of both. I think people, when they're building a new home or doing remodeling in an existing home, they like some of the character that reclaimed wood offers. And that's just the design niche that they're going for.
And I'm sure that you hear a lot of reasons why people are drawn to the reclaimed wood. You mentioned that it looks really cool. But I'm also guessing you hear from a lot of people who say, I like the fact that this wood isn't going to waste. Can you talk some about how much wood waste is generated nationally each year?
Yeah, certainly a great deal of wood waste is generated nationally. Again, I can't give you exact numbers, but it makes up a significant portion of the landfill material that that goes into landfills from deconstruction. Some of the estimates range around 55 million tons of wood waste is generated on an annual basis in the U.S. And they believe that about half of this material is of acceptable size and quality that can actually be reused.
You mentioned that a lot of this wood goes into landfills if it's not being salvaged. Is there anywhere else that this wood waste ends up?
Well, sometimes what happens, it's kind of a lower value-added use, is if it's pulled out of the waste stream, it can be ground up and used for fuel, or it can be used for things like landscape mulch. But if you can think of a higher value use, like reusing it in a decorative application, it certainly adds more life to the product, because once it's turned into fuel or mulch, it's consumed quite rapidly.
And I'm wondering, too, are there certain kinds of trees or are there certain kind of woods that really lend themselves nicely to this kind of process, or ones that you find people really wanting for their homes?
Well, I think a lot of that really depends. We have both softwoods, and those are woods that come from needle-bearing trees. Those are mainly used in construction to hold up our walls, things that you don't necessarily see. Those are often used as beams and structural supports in larger buildings, factories, things that are being deconstructed. But then you also have hardwoods, and hardwoods are the broadleaf trees that we have growing in the state. And again, those, you know, also were being used for beams and columns and buildings. It all depended upon what was available for use, especially when you look at old barns. Typically, when old barns were built, they used what they had on the land. So it could be, you know, a combination of both hardwood and softwood.
And so other than the waste reduction and, you know, the fact that this wood looks cool, I'm wondering if you could speak to some of the other benefits of this unbuilding process. And do you see benefits to local economies here in Wisconsin?
Well, certainly there's really a couple of benefits. There's benefits to local economies in the fact that it does take more labor to basically deconstruct this type of material and reuse it. So not only in the deconstruction process, but also in the reprocessing. So, for example, let's suppose we take a beam from an old factory. If we're going to turn that beam into wood flooring or wood paneling, there's labor involved in the deconstruction and labor involved in the reprocessing. So it gives back to our local economies by providing jobs that help the economy.
We're talking right now with Scott Bovey. He's a professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. And, Scott, I'm guessing that you sort of alluded to the labor there. I'm guessing you can't just take the wood from a demolished barn and then immediately turn around and use it. What's the process that this wood must go through before it can take on a new life?
Yeah, so if you're going to take a beam and sort of add value to it by making it into a paneling or flooring product, the first thing you need to do is look for metal, because of the bolts and nails and other things. Those old fasteners will damage your milling equipment, so that has to be removed by hand, and then the product can be resawn into a usable thickness that you can make flooring or paneling from. And then typically you have to also re-dry the product, because you want to make sure that the product is dried to a dimensionally stable moisture content. And you also want to make sure that any insects that could potentially be in the product are killed. For example, powder post beetle is a very common insect that you can find in old barns. And if you would use that material in your home, those beetles could actually hatch from within the material and infest your home. So that's something you want to be careful about.
And are there times where wood just can't be reclaimed, or are these issues that you're talking about things that can really be prevented or worked on before maybe a new table or a floor is brought into a house?
Yeah, certainly I think there, you know, it all depends upon how much effort you want to put into it. You can certainly reclaim products as long as it's large enough and in sound shape. But it is going to be, it is going to take time, and it's going to take money to actually upgrade that product into something that's usable. One example of using a reclaimed product might be, let's suppose you want to put some decorative beams in a home or in a basement or remodeling project. Then you wouldn't necessarily need to do a lot of work to these, just because you may want that rustic look. But if you're going to take the beam and remanufacture it into something smaller, then it'll take more effort to make that a usable product.
Where would somebody go to try to get their hands on this kind of wood? Where could I go as a customer to get what you're talking about here?
Well, certainly the first place to go is to your computer. And if you type Reclaimed Wood Wisconsin, you're going to find a number of different companies that specialize in this. In my local area, Enterprise Wood Products in Rhinelander specializes in reclaimed wood products. So there's, depending upon where you live in the state, you'll certainly find a company that works in this type of product.
And then on the flip side of that, if I'm, let's say I'm a farmer in northern Wisconsin and I've got a barn to come down, and this barn has been there for a long time, and I know there are going to be some people out there who want to get their hands on this product, do I do the same thing? Do I call up the same company?
Yes, I would do the same thing, because most of these companies, if they do not deconstruct themselves, they work with specific specialists that do the deconstruction for them. So they could certainly point you in the right direction.
So I'm guessing all of this comes with a little bit of a cost. How much of a price difference might a customer be looking at between reclaimed wood and non-reclaimed wood?
It is a little bit more expensive. It's usually about twice the cost of a newly sawn virgin raw material. And a lot of that has to do with just all the labor that goes back into upgrading that product into something that you could use in your home or business.
And I know you didn't touch on this in the piece, but I'm wondering, is this something, you know, if I'm trying to sell my house and I can point to, I've got hardwood floors that were repurposed wood from a barn in Wisconsin, do you know if this is something that's really driving up resale value?
Well, I would be skeptical to say that. That might be something you'd want to say, and people might say, oh, that's neat. But it may not be for everyone. So certainly, with the cost of using this product, if you plan on selling your home soon, maybe this is a route you wouldn't want to go. But if you're looking to stay in your home for a long time and you would like to do some remodeling, you can do some pretty innovative things with this type of product.
Does the unbuilt and reused material market, whether it be wood or otherwise, have significant potential to grow here in Wisconsin in the coming years?
I think it will continue to grow. However, I think it will continue to be a niche market, just because it only appeals to some people, and others may want to continue buying newly produced products.
Well, Scott, thanks for joining us today.
That's been my pleasure.
That was Scott Bovey, a professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He recently wrote about the demand for reclaimed wood in the state, and you can read his full piece over at wiscontext.org.
Growing up Muslim in North Dakota during the 1980s and 90s, Dilshad Ali learned to play down her faith publicly as a method of survival.
Now a parent raising children of her own, she's flipped the script. She wants her kids to be unapologetically Muslim and not to hide any part of themselves.
Dilshad Ali shared her thoughts in a piece for The Atlantic. She's managing editor of Patheos Muslim at patheos.com, a media company focused on religion and spirituality. Dilshad, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
In the piece for The Atlantic that you wrote, you talk about how it was uncomfortable growing up a Muslim teenager in North Dakota right as the Gulf War broke out. Can you share a little bit about those experiences with us?
Sure. It definitely was something that was more uncomfortable in that particular time period, which is something I want to note because, you know, we had been there for most of my childhood into teenage life, and even though we were one of the only Muslim families in town, we definitely felt part of the town community and the university community out there. But the Gulf War was unique because it was in the Gulf, and there was this dictator named Saddam Hussein that suddenly everyone was familiar with, and his name was on the news all the time. And Grand Forks Air Force Base, which is one of the larger Air Force bases, at least in the 1980s and 90s, it was maybe the second or third largest, which I can't confirm that, but I remember that it was a large Air Force base, and the high schoolers all came to our high school off of the Air Force Base. So all of a sudden in high school, there was an influx of a lot of kids coming from a lot of different places who had lived in a lot of different places. So, and they had seemingly either a father or an older brother or an uncle or somebody who had been deployed to Iraq. So it was a little uncomfortable. We were there in school, my brother and I. We have an older brother who was in college, and he was a senior, I was a sophomore. And our last name's Hussein, and we're brown, and we're South Asian. We're not Middle Eastern, but those kind of details kind of fall to the wayside, you know, in your teenage years. And it's funny, my brother and I were discussing this after the article came out, and he recalls not feeling that same feeling that I was feeling, and I reminded him that you were a senior and well-established, and I was a sophomore, which was when high school started in Grand Forks. It didn't start in ninth grade. It started in 10th. And I didn't know that many people, and I felt at times, you know, going into new classes and hearing my name called out and, you know, people making jokes in the halls. You know, I felt a little uncomfortable for sure at times.
Well, and fast forwarding a couple decades, you're a parent now, and you have two kids in high school, one in elementary school. And in the interim, we've had, you know, the war on terror, we've had 9/11. How is the environment different for them, or is it, than it was for you in high school?
There are things that have remained the same, and there are things that are definitely different now. I think there's, you know, the world has become a lot smaller now. I mean, it's a cliche to say that, but it's the truth. I think we all know a lot more about each other. I think different parts of the world are more familiar to us here in America now. So what's different, I feel, about the high school experience with my kids right now is that, you know, they study a lot more different things than we did. There's a focus on international studies. There's a focus on learning about different regions of the world. And there's a little bit more knowledge about current events. I would say a lot more knowledge about current events. You know, there's CNN in the classroom and other things that they do over there that wasn't done when I was in school. So in that sense, it's different. You know, there's a lot more information that these kids come into with. You know, they are all plugged into their iPhones. They all have their social media feeds. And yeah, predominantly that's used for whatever things high school kids use it for. But also, you know, they are more aware and more connected to hearing what's happening out there in the world than we were. So that's different. What isn't different, and actually what I feel is a little harder now, is that feeling of otherization, that feeling of, you know, that you're not part of the community or you're not American enough or something. It feels a little more intense now, or it looks to me. And this is not just from what I know as a parent or what I see as a parent, but what I know and hear from my reporting in coordination of coverage of American Muslims in the United States, which I do for work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. You would think that there would be, you know, a moving towards more harmony and understanding now that the world is smaller and we know more about each other, but it feels a little more divisive. It is a bit more divisive in these recent times. You know, and there are studies and statistics that show this that I could quote to you, but it feels more divisive now than it did in the immediate years after 9/11.
Hmm.
So, you know, there's these shifts that happened, and I see that in the schools where my kids go to. I see that in the schools where friends' children go to, and they're dealing with a lot of other things that never were part of the landscape when we were in high school.
We're talking with Dilshad Ali right now. She's managing editor of Patheos Muslim at patheos.com, and she's written a couple recent pieces about raising her children to be unapologetically Muslim. And Dilshad, actually, I want to transition to that. You write about the need or the desire to have your kids be unapologetically Muslim, and I wonder if you can tell us what that means to you as a parent and as a Muslim woman.
I think it really kind of boils down to about two things for me. When I say unapologetic, I think there was a time period following 9/11 and the several years after that when anytime there was an act of terrorism or an act of violence, whether or not the perpetrators were Muslims or so-called Muslims, as I like to call it, there's this expectation of being apologetic and needing to be apologetic and condemn things that you hear about in the news. And those condemnations still come from all the major organizations and the major players out there. But why should they have to come from, you know, people living their normal lives, from teens in school, from parents on the street, and your doctor at the doctor's office? I mean, it has nothing to do with us. It's not any connection to us. So in that way, that's part of what I mean by wanting them to be unapologetic. And the other part of being unapologetic to me is not about, you know, being public and loud about your faith in public spheres, but more about, you know, being comfortable with who you are and knowing your self-worth and knowing, you know, if there's something you want to ask for, that it's your right to ask for it. If there's something you don't want to be bothered by, it's your right to say, don't bother me about that. And to feel, you know, that self-confidence. And that's, you know, what I really mean by being unapologetic. You know, not feeling quiet or not feeling like you have to be shy or quiet about who you are or what you practice or what happens in your home, but that you can be confident about that and confident about yourself and stand up for yourself wherever you need to.
Dilshad, you wrote an initial piece for The Atlantic and then a follow-up for Pathos.com. What kind of response did you get?
You know, you get the gamut of responses. I mean, there's definitely the responses of people who take offense to what I write, who look at the words of unapologetic or being loud and, you know, say, you know, why do you have to bring religion into the classroom? You know, you're indoctrinating your children, or what about free thinking? I definitely got pushback like that. But I also got a lot of positive responses from people within the Muslim community or immigrant community, and also people who are not Muslim, you know, other Americans, about relating to the story, knowing, you know, that this story is similar to the story that they had with their parents growing up or they have with their children now. And also from people who are not Muslim or, you know, who don't come from an immigrant background or are not South Asian or Middle Eastern or whatever, and, you know, just like to hear the story and, you know, like to know what our experience was and just the vast amount of experiences we all have in growing up in this country, you know. So it's been a lot of good. When you write something, you learn not to read the comments. So I'm trying not to do that.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Dilshad, if there was one thing that could change in American society and culture that would make it easier for your kids to not have to be consciously unapologetic, just to be themselves, what do you think that would be?
I think all of us need to have a greater level of understanding for each other's experiences and understand that we're not always going to know the places from which the other person comes from. And so that open-mindedness that we're trying to teach should be part of what I hope all parents would impart to their children. I mean, parenting is imparting what you know and what you think is right and what you want your children to grow up to. I mean, that just is what it is. But at the same time, if we can also teach, you know, our children to be open-minded, to be more accepting, you know, to be willing to hear people, you know, to, instead of talking, you know, open up your ears and listen to what other people's experiences are before you pass judgment or before you shut that door and brush them off, I think that would make things a lot easier, you know, for us to get to know each other. You know, that whole idea of just knowing your next door neighbor or knowing that one person who seems a little unfamiliar to you, I mean, it really can affect and change a lot of things.
Well, Dilshad, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
That was Dilshad Ali. She's managing editor of Pathos Muslim at Pathos.com. She joined us to talk about her recent piece for The Atlantic, Raising My Kids to Be Unapologetic American Muslims.
There's more Central Time just ahead. And join us Friday night at 7 for the Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate debates. WPT's Frederica Freiberg and WPR's Sean Johnson will moderate the debate between Michael Skrenick and Rebecca Dallet as they vie for a seat on the state's highest court. That's the Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate debate Friday night at 7 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
On On yesterday's show, we asked you to tell us about your first car, and boy, did you all deliver. We couldn't squeeze in all your calls, so we asked you to keep the stories coming over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and we thought we'd share a few today.
A lot of commenters had fond memories. Sherry says her first car was a 1974 Ford Mustang II, a four-speed with a moonroof, and it was red and black. She says it was a pretty fun car for a 16-year-old, even though it was almost as old as she was.
But not surprisingly, I guess some drivers were less than enthused with their first rides. Linda writes, I hated my first car. It was a Chevy Chevette, and it regularly lost steam when going uphill or trying to merge onto an expressway. It was awful.
Some listeners had to make some tough decisions when they were younger. We heard from Joseph, who wrote, mine was an 83 Caprice Classic. No pictures, though. It was either gas or film. I chose gas. He also went on to explain what film was for us younger folks. So thanks for that, Joseph.
And Justin wrote, I had a 2001 RT Dodge Durango. I loved that thing. It was a rocket. But don't miss the 12 miles per gallon, and I'm curious how high school me afforded gas.
I kind of wonder about that, too. Like,
I know. My old Delta 88 was not exactly fuel efficient.
I had a station wagon. I feel you there, Judith.
There you go. Well, you can keep sharing more memories about your first cars over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're listening to Central Time.